This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. What gets remembered and what gets erased? In this episode of Writer's Voice, marking Women's History Month, we explore the lives and legacies of women who made innovative contributions to both journalism and science, but were often overlooked. Julia Cook discusses Starry and Restless, her group biography of Rebecca West, Martha Gellhorn, and Emily Mickey Hahn, women journalists whose restless lives and innovative writing help shape modern literary journalism, even as their work was later minimized. Then Ida Turpainen explores extinction, empire, and memory in her novel Beasts of the Sea, beginning with the story of the stellar sea cow and expanding into a meditation on loss, and a forgotten figure, scientific illustrator Hilda Olson, whose work helped document the natural world. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In this last episode of Women's History Month in 2026, Julia Cook re-examines the legacy of three pioneering women journalists, Rebecca West, Martha Gellhorn, and Mickey Hahn. While they were all famous in their time, the importance of their contribution to a new kind of journalism, what today is seen as being in the genre of creative nonfiction, has been unrecognized. Until now. In her book, Starry and Restless, Julia Cook argues that these women were central to the development of literary journalism. Cook shows how the constraints placed on women, excluded from war fronts, dismissed as, quote, sob sisters, pushed them to innovate. Their reporting expanded journalism scope to include domestic life, civilian experience, and overlooked voices, while challenging traditional ideas of objectivity. Their work not only reshaped journalism in their time, but continues to influence how stories are told today. Let's listen now. Julia Cook, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was a terrifically written book and fascinating in its history of three really important women journalists who were unique in their own right in some ways, but who also in many ways in this book represent the larger field or topic of women journalists. But I want to zero in first on the title. It's Starry and Restless, Three Women Who Changed Work, Writing, and the World. The central idea does seem to be restlessness, work, and freedom. You frame these three women, Rebecca West, Martha Gellhorn, and Mickey Hahn, as restless. And what did that word mean for you as you wrote this book? And also then introduce us to them.
Yeah. Well, you know, restlessness has been a pretty central impulse of mine for a long time. And it's been something that I've been thinking about as pertains women in particular for years and years and years. I guess you could classify my first book as travel writing in a way. It was very animated by my own restlessness. And then my second book was about women stewardesses in the jet age, women who chose an acceptably feminine role that would prioritize their own restlessness. It was a way for, a kind of good girl in the 60s and 70s who was also incredibly wanderlusty to indulge her own wanderlust without giving up on kind of the feminine norm, shall we say. And so this book was also really animated by that central impulse and ambition. And I found that the three women at the center of this book, and frankly, many, many other women, you know, this book centers on three women, but there's a pretty broad chorus around them. A lot of women in the early 20th century were really following their instincts to get out into the bigger world. And I found it very curious that a lot of their contributions to the literary canon and the journalistic canon had been kind of minimized, I think, by nature of their restlessness, the fact that they were writing about a world that was confusing and scary to a lot of people then, and then that becomes less important now as writing is canonized in various syllabi and academic institutions. The three women at the center of the book are Rebecca West, Mickey Hahn, Emily Hahn, her mother gave her the nickname of Mickey when she was a little girl and that stuck, and Martha Gellhorn, all of whom wrote for the best magazines in the U.S. West was British, but wrote for a lot of really important American magazines and were really famous in their era, but kind of fell out of the broader, more central conversations around American literary journalism in the 20th century.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about some of the background, historical background. You introduced the main body of the book with a chapter called The Woman Journalist, and you make a strong corrective argument that women were not marginal to the development of literary journalism, but central to it. So tell us about that centrality of their role.
Totally. It was shocking to me to understand the centrality of their role. I'm so glad that you phrase it that way, because that's what I came to understand it as. I was taught that the literary journalism canon was really revolutionized in the 60s and 70s, and that there were a couple of men who were doing interesting writing earlier than that, but that really, you know, what we now consider to be literary journalism, journalism that is very rigorously factual, but also stylistically takes its cues from fiction, innovatively stylistic, voice-driven, that writing, you know, began in force in the 60s and 70s, and that there were a couple of men before then who were doing interesting work, but not that many, and certainly no women. And when I started researching this book, what I found thrilled me, that that's just not at all what happened. Women were out there. Women have been central to voice-driven narrative journalism for at least the last century and a half, certainly since Nellie Bly. And there are arguments that even before her, women were central to American journalism. Numbers are enormous. Women were hardly contributing, you know, to 8% of the copy in American newspapers. They were contributing 25% of the copy in American newspapers in the very beginning of the 20th century. Nellie Bly was immersing herself in what Hunter S. Thompson would certainly call gonzo journalism stunts in 1892. You know, there were activist journalists who were embedding themselves in homeless shelters, who a woman who traveled across the Atlantic Ocean from Ireland to Ellis Island to expose corruption in the immigration service in 1921. You know, the list goes on and on and on about these innovative, dogged, and stylistically wonderful journalists. And yet they've really fallen out of the narrative history of American journalism, which tends to center men's contributions.
Yes. And actually, Rebecca West was a novelist as well as a journalist. Tell us a little bit more about her. She was the first one in this trio, I think, to really become well known. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. She was a fair amount older than Mickey and Martha. She was born in 1892, I believe. She was about 12 to 13 years older than the two of them. And she also started writing and publishing at an incredibly young age. She was still a teenager. You know, she moved up really quickly. She was writing important book reviews at age 20. So, you know, she was going from a really young age. And once she started writing, she just really never stopped. She was incredibly prolific. She wrote all the time, and she wrote across a really broad range of styles. She did book reviews, fiction. She reported on, you know, immersive scenes and on a dynamite factory in England, right, before World War I. She was writing personal essays that we, you know, and travel writing. And she just never stopped. It's really remarkable to look at the range of her writing.
You show that a lot of these journalists were Well, on the one hand, they were trivialized in the press. You know, they were called sob sisters or stunt girls, writers of the women's angle. Yet those very constraints, it seemed to me as I read your book, actually helped them generate these new kinds of reporting. I wonder if you could say more about that and give us a few examples.
Absolutely. You know, I found that the very constraints that were placed on women journalists. So, for example, in World War I and World War II, women journalists were not permitted to report from the front of the war. So that did two things. Number one, it meant that they were writing stories from different angles. So they were writing about hospitals and the ways that the villages near the war front were figuring out how to, you know, make ends meet and get food. Like the food ways were fascinating for them to be writing about. They were writing about family life in wartime and, you know, architectural consequences of a war, which are now we understand that all of these consequences of conflict are important and happen and should be covered. But back then, it was not quite as usual. So they were on the one hand innovating in terms of what kinds of stories they were telling. And then they were also really innovatively including their own perspective, like the way that they were figuring out how to get around those constraints in order to report from the front when they were able to do so. So that insertion of that kind of first person perspective and kind of the meta story around the reported story was really novel.
Yeah, and just to go back to a minute to Rebecca West, she went to the former Yugoslavia and she was married at the time, but she went alone. And I think one of the most salient parts of her experience there was the constant harassment she was getting from her guide, her state supplied guide. Talk about this other element. You know, I think we're so aware that women in general, including today, you know, are subject to so much of this kind of harassment. How did she deal with that?
You know, she dealt with it in I think a way that is quite common across certainly the women that I was writing about. And frankly, it's still common today, which is you deal with it and move on, right? Like you reject the potential suitor, you protect yourself as much as you, and by suitor, that's a very decorous way to refer to someone who's harassing you. But, you know, she would push him off, lock her doors, keep herself safe as much as she could, and then just keep going. You know, I think that back then and today, there's this perception that women should not travel because it's not as safe for women, because men are not, you know, there are lots of bad actors around and the eyes of neighborhood busybodies and your community can't help keep you safe if you're on the road. But the reality is, if you look at it statistically, you know, women are less safe and more likely to be subject to intimate partner violence or violence at home than they are in various places in the world. You know, there are a lot of situations in which women are not safe, and traveling is not necessarily one of them.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with Julia Cook about her terrific new biography of three pioneering journalists, Rebecca West, Martha Gellhorn, and Mickey Hahn. Her book is Starry and Restless, Three Women Who Changed Work, Writing, and the World. And so these three women who stepped so far outside of what was supposed to be accepted employment for women were still hugely successful and honored, although not so honored with the financial resources that they needed in order to pursue their work. What do you think enabled these women to overcome the barriers that they did to acceptance during their time?
I think that they were all really compulsive writers. They were all incredibly determined. They all really followed their instincts. And I think that's very valuable in any person, especially a writer, especially a woman writer. They didn't take no for an answer. If they heard no, they would find a different way to do what they wanted to do, or they would adjust what they needed to do in order to you know, make it fit. You know, you're talking about financial resources. They would get assignments from, you know, less exciting magazines to write fluffy stories in order to go write the story that they really wanted to write. Or they would write novels. You know, their agents for Mickey and Martha in particular, their agents were constantly asking them for novels because they could churn them out. And so they wrote lots of short stories. Martha did a lot of short stories, and Mickey wrote a fair amount of novels just to fund their writing life. And on some level, that got in the way of their critical reception. They became wildly famous in their era, but didn't kind of stick around in the canon in the same way that other people might have, in part because they just published so much and such a huge variety. And there's a huge variation of quality also, right? Like some of Mickey's books are not that great. Some of them are really wonderful. She wrote 50 some odd books in her lifetime and 181 pieces for The New Yorker. And some are really, really powerful and important. And others are just, she wrote them to make money in order to keep writing. No, it was an assignment that she met because she was a professional writer. And so that, you know, that had consequences too.
Talk a little bit about how these women approached the idea of objectivity. I mean, you referred before to how they put themselves, their voice, they were part of the story. In other words, you know, something which in traditional journalism, you're not supposed to be part of the story, although how you can actually separate yourself from the story you're reporting on, I've never been able to totally understand.
Totally. Yeah. No, I think that, you know, there are a couple of ways to answer that question. And, you know, it is also important to note that there were men who were also experimenting with using the first person. This was not a uniquely feminine thing to do. It's just that women were attuned and some might say culturally trained to notice different details than the men might have. And women were limited by regulations that kept them from equal access to official briefings or war fronts or anything else, whereas the men were invited into those spaces. So I think that sense of access kind of defined their perception of what objectivity might be from the very beginning. They were not invited into that sense of objectivity. They understood the porosity of the omniscient third person perspective from the very beginning on both a life level and on a writing level. And so they were aware of and noticing lots of different people than the men journalists might have been aware of and might have been noticing in their reporting. They were noticing women and children and maids and service people that men were often overlooking. And so they employed a uniquely 360-degree perspective that included their own perspective and that was from the very start very skeptical of the authority figures who had excluded them.
So they would really be able to broaden not only the scope of journalism, but actually report a different kind of story that would bring a wider perspective to it.
Completely. They really broadened perspectives of who might be a valid source, what kinds of scenes deserved the dignity of reproduction in print.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of, you know, the difference in approach to history as well, that I think this parallels, you know, one approach to history, the great man theory of history, versus the more quotidian examination of the quotidian, of the daily, of the domestic sphere, which is also not just is not just something that only women historians did, but women historians have really been able to highlight, I think, to a greater degree.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's tough because there is this duality here, right? Each of these women was really exceptional. They came from an upbringing. They all came from upbringings that had a really distinctive balance of privilege and also, you know, grit. They really had just enough privilege to get themselves going or gain access to like the language of privilege, but not quite enough to do nothing with it. And they often felt like outsiders in various contexts. They were exceptional in a lot of ways, but at the same time, they were very aware that the notion of exceptionalism was kind of BS, right? That like this great man theory is a fallacy, that people work in concert with other people, that communities are really important. They grew up with siblings. Rebecca West and Mickey Hahn in particular were very close Mickey Hahn was close with her sisters. Rebecca West was not close with her sisters, but had sisters and was very aware of this notion. She was an incredible friend to a lot of people. In her obituary that Molly Panter Downs, who was another New Yorker writer, wrote of Rebecca West, she highlighted West's capacity for friendship and the amount of other women, particularly younger women writers, who looked to her as a friend. She was an incredibly generous and loyal friend to a lot of people. So their notion of and awareness of the kind of fallacy of that great man theory was really important.
So now let's talk a little bit about war, because Martha Gellin was a war correspondent, and they all did. I mean, war has been a major feature of the 20th and now 21st century, so I can understand why. But Mickey Hahn said that when she was under danger, she felt, quote, normal again.
I know. I love that quote. I think it's so fascinating as far as pointing us toward her, as far as a way to understand her as a person and her psyche. That quote is just an incredible one. You know, Martha Gellhorn was the only one of the three who wrote about war, in terms of its formal reporting, right? She was a war correspondent. Both Rebecca West and Mickey Hahn wrote about war because it was what was happening in that moment. And it was an inescapable feature of public life and writing life. If you wanted to write about the world in 1940, you were writing about war, because you were living it, right? Like Mickey Hahn was living in Shanghai when it came under Japanese occupation. So, you know, when she was moving house, she was writing about moving house under falling bombs. And that was just a fact of the life that she was living, which is a really interesting way to consider the documentation of a war.
Yeah, and say something also that Rebecca's work reinvented epic heroism in feminist terms. So, what do you mean by that?
There's a really wonderful scholarly paper that I read that by, I think her name is Angela Carlson. It's somewhere in the footnotes. But she writes a whole long story about, or rather, this scholar wrote a long explication of Black Lamb and Gray Falcon, which is Rebecca West's masterpiece. It's 1,100 pages. And it is a woman who is heading to Yugoslavia, in contrast to Odysseus, who's going to fight, coming home from war. You know, Rebecca West is going to Yugoslavia in order to understand why the next world war is going to happen, how it's going to happen, how these, you know, the conflicts in Europe that were pointing toward World War II, she wanted to understand how and why that might happen in order to, you know, grandiosely thinking in order to prevent it. So it's an opposite type of impulse. But she's also, you know, she is claiming the same kind of storytelling impulse, bringing you into the various challenges that she's facing along the journey, but it has a totally opposite goal. And while she's traveling on that journey, she is uniquely observant of various women. There's this incredible moment where she's interviewing the sister of the man who first tried to kill Franz Ferdinand in Bosnia, and she's sitting in their living room having this long conversation, and she has this moment where she says, "I've always been so curious about the women behind the great men of history. You know, what happened to St. Augustine's mother? How did she get out of their lease? What were these women doing to make the lives possible of these great men who were creating the history that we read about in history books?" So that attunement to what is happening around these stories that get passed down in generations was what conditioned this notion of epic heroism, but in feminine terms.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Julia Cook about her triple biography, Starry and Restless, Three Women Who Changed Work, Writing, and the World. It's about Rebecca West, Martha Gellhorn, and Mickey Hahn, the great journalists. Now, Martha Gellhorn, as you say, was a war correspondent. I mean, the scenes that she witnessed in the Spanish Civil War, her incredible bravery in it, and her meeting Ernest Hemingway, who she ended up with for many years. How did she change war correspondence in particular? I mean, we've talked about how they have all, you know, changed the way people wrote about war. But as a war correspondent, someone who confronted the violence, how did she change it?
Yeah. So there was this moment in the Spanish Civil War. I was lucky enough to be granted access to her personal notes in her archives there at Boston University, and they were closed to the public until last year. Last year they opened up, and I was able to look at them years ago for the research for this book. And there's this note that she has in her Spanish Civil War notes where she talks about how this this man who was supposed to transmit one of her what was supposed to cable a story of hers started laughing and was like, it's only a human interest story. And she, you can feel the rage in even her notes, because you can feel her pointing at this idea of, you know, what is war if not a human interest? Like, we are humans experiencing and waging war. And, you know, all around her in Madrid, she was looking at the consequences, the human consequences of war. And so that attunement to how integral the notion of, you know, what a human interest story might be is her great contribution to war correspondence. She was particularly attuned to domesticity in ways that are not typically what you might assume a woman might be attuned to. She loved making houses. For the rest of her life, she would go to great pains to settle a house. She really cared about like interior design and paint colors and making things feel like clean and livable and pretty. And so she had that attunement inherent to her perspective. She would go to these war zones and pick up on these details that other journalists might totally skip. And I think that that is one of the loveliest and most important things that she did for writing about war.
One of the deepest arguments, I think, in this book is that domestic life itself is not separate from literary life, not just in the sense of what you're writing about, but that it shapes whether women can think, whether they can travel, whether they can write at all. And that came, there's tension in the book. You know, for example, Martha Gellhorn's relationship with Ernest Hemingway and their home in Cuba, how she felt it was, the home was both a place of bliss and a place of confinement.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that it helps that I wrote this book in a period of great confinement myself. I sold this book. I started thinking about it in 2018 when I was considering starting a family, having children with my husband. I had just gotten married in 2016. And I sold it right after I had given birth to twins, who were born 19 months after my eldest was born. So I had three very, very small children when I started really working on this book. And I wrote it. I gave myself a long period of time to write it, you know, a good couple of years so that I wouldn't have immediate deadlines. And so feeling that tension between wanting to write, wanting to be out in the world, and kind of being unable to, in my case, I just had too many children at home who I love very, very much, obviously. And I'm really grateful to have so much time to spend with them. I live in a small town in Vermont. It's pretty simple and pretty small. And I'm really lucky to be able to balance writing and family life in a way that feels that both of those sides of things are fulfilling. But I don't get out all that much. I don't travel all that much. And that sense of frustration that I often feel at not being able to do the kind of long-form journalism that I used to do, it helped me to pick up on different elements of their stories, like different notes that they wrote in letters or ways that they had of writing about things at different periods of their lives. I had never felt a period of my life like that before the last couple of years. And so I'm grateful to have had that experience in order to be able to understand their lives in different ways. And, you know, obviously this all bears saying that we are all living wildly different lives. This is a totally different time period than the one that they lived in, with completely different, you know, support systems and sociocultural ways of looking at women writers and mothers and all of that. But in terms of the ways that I would notice the tonalities of the different years of their lives, it was fundamentally changed.
Say a little bit more about that process of, because I mean, I'm not so sure it's all that different today. Today, women are more accepted as members of the writing field, of course.
Oh, yes.
But on the other hand, I think the contradictions of domesticity, the contradictions of relationships with men, with competition, you know, maybe haven't changed all that much.
I couldn't agree more. In my particular case, though, I have I happen to be married to a man who is very domestically capable. And so that is something that I was very grateful for every day that I was writing. You know, the women in this book did not have husbands who did things like housework or who, you know, cared for children in hands-on ways or, you know, considered a home something that was the responsibility of both members of a partnership. So in terms of my own domestic and private life, it was very different from theirs. In terms of the public life, though, you're totally right. I think that the tensions remain and they're pretty startlingly undifferent. The ways that people talk about mothers in particular has been really interesting and startling to me. The ways that certain, you know, I think you're the first, you may be one of the first interviewers to really overtly ask me about domesticity and motherhood in this book. It's definitely a thread that's there, but it's not been enormously picked up on yet. And it reminds me of the fact that in Mickey Hahn's book that she wrote about in 1949, she published a book called England to Me. It was picking up on China to Me, which was a wildly best-selling book that she wrote about living in China before and during the war, World War II, the Pacific Front. She was intimately involved in that period of time and found it a really interesting time. So she wrote this expose type book, not quite confessional, but very frank memoir of her time in China. And then she did it again in England, except that now she was married to, you know, a somewhat posh British guy and living on this estate in Dorset. And she wrote this book that was really animated by domesticity and, you know, considering domesticity as it reflected the cultural currents and the politics of the era. And it was very, and she was very attuned to motherhood. I think I put it in Starry and Restless that there's this like chorus of maternal ambivalence in England to Me that I found incredibly compelling. All of these women kind of talking about why having these children is so hard and also so wonderful, but also so hard. And not a single reviewer that I was able to find really brought that thread out of England to Me. They all focused much more on very different elements of it. And it kind of broke my heart because Mickey never wrote again with such candor about motherhood in that way. And it made me sad for her.
Yeah. And also we should just mention that she was involved romantically with a Chinese man, which also I think perhaps broke more boundaries than even the fact of her writing about China.
Totally. Her two big relationships were scandalous in totally different ways. Her first big relationship was with a Chinese poet and playboy, and it was very, very scandalous in Shanghai in the late 30s because, you know, as accepting as the international intelligentsia was, and the expat community loved inviting what they called interesting Chinese people to their dinner parties. And, you know, this integrated sense of socializing was very new there, but a white woman did not have sexual relationship with a Chinese man. And Mickey not only did, but was totally proud and open about it. And then wrote about it very frankly in China to Me. And then her second relationship with the man that she wound up marrying was with the head of British intelligence in Hong Kong, the head of British intelligence for the Far East, Charles Boxer, who was a war hero and a prominent scholar, a brilliant man. But he was married when they first got together and when Mickey got pregnant with their baby. And then he was captured in the Battle of Hong Kong and was in a POW camp for years. And when he was released after the war, he came to New York and found her and they got married. And it was this whole well-publicized marriage that made a respectable woman of Mickey, which I think felt more like, I think she felt like she was like cosplaying respectability in some very real way. that made her feel very uncomfortable, which I identify with on some level. I've been reflecting a lot on how, you know, the life that I'm living right now feels very respectable compared to when I was in my 20s and, you know, living in Havana to report on youth culture and go to punk rock shows, and a lot more interesting back then. But Mickey was not ashamed of any part of her life, and she wrote about it with utter frankness. And I think that's part of why then England to me, and her turn toward examination of more domestic themes really struck people as so unusual for her. And yet to me, it feels totally predictable because she was so interested in various aspects of that life that she was living. She was not picking up on the same things that, you know, a capable domestic might pick up on. She hated cooking and could not keep a house to save her life. Literally told her daughter not to learn how to cook or drive a car, because if she did, men would take advantage of it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Wonderful advice.
I know, right? Like defensive, what I think of it in my head as defensive incompetence.
That's great. Well, your book, Starry and Restless, just a terrific read, and a very important book, I think, for what it brings to the conversation about women's contribution, huge contribution to journalism and to writing in general. Julia Cook, thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved this.
Julia Cook is also the author of Come Fly the World and The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. Find a link to an excerpt to Starry and Restless at writersvoice.net. Next up, what do we remember before it's too late? Ida Turpainen is next. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Ida Turpainen's historical novel, Beasts of the Sea, is based on true events, beginning with the discovery of the Steller sea cow, a species driven to extinction within decades of discovery, and explores how science, empire, and extraction were deeply intertwined. The novel also brings forward an overlooked figure in the history of science, Hilda Olson, a 19th century scientific illustrator whose contributions were long obscured. Turpainen contrasts dominant modes of scientific seeing, cataloging, naming, possessing, with Olson's more attentive, observational approach, one grounded in care as much as accuracy. At its heart, Beasts of the Sea is both an elegy for a lost species and a meditation on memory, on how easily both lives and contributions can vanish from view. Let's listen now. This is a very beautiful novel. It's not like many other novels because it's not so much plot-driven as driven, I think, by ideas. And those ideas cover things like extinction and human responsibility, science as both care and violence, empire and extraction, seeing versus possessing. So let's dive in. The novel begins with a skeleton in a museum. It's the remains of the Steller sea cow, which I assume is the beast of the sea of the title.
Yes.
So tell us about this animal.
Well, it really was a fascinating creature. You can imagine kind of a manatee. It was a close relation to a manatee. It was a dugong the size of a whale. It could grow as long as 10 meters long, weighed 9 tons. So it was massive and huge animal living in the Arctic waters of the Bering Sea. It was a very gentle and caring animal. It took care of its young, very, very, it was very nurturing, very tactile. Steller, the only person whose account of the encounter with this animal we have, described them as very, very gentle creatures. They liked to caress their young, and they lived in big herds in the 18th century when this animal was discovered by science. It was living only in this waters of this small island in the middle of the Bering Sea. That was the last herd that remained.
Yeah, so you've mentioned Bering and we've talked about Stellar. Tell us about this expedition in
Yes,
1741.
1741, I think, was when they set off. So at that time, there was the wish to find a sea route from Siberia to Alaska. And 20 years prior to that, the first attempt was made. But at that time, they had estimated the distance between the two continents wrongly, and they assumed it would be a much shorter trip than it was. And they returned without finding the coast of Alaska. But 20 years later, they tried again. And this time it was Captain Vitus Bering and his crew, and they set to sail from Peninsula of Kamchatka, and their goal was to find the coast of America. So they wanted to sail to Alaska. And this time they actually succeeded. They found the coast, and but then once again the trip had been longer than they had anticipated, and when they headed home, the winds weren't favorable. They started to run out of food and water. And what eventually happened is they got shipwrecked on this desolate, unknown island in the middle of Bering Sea.
What was the purpose of this? I mean, yes, to find a sea route, but what was behind it?
Well, it was, of course, this imperial idea of expanding the influence of the Russian Empire. And that happened. Alaska was under Russian influence until the 1860s. So from that on, Alaska was part of the Russian Empire. And it was, of course, because Alaska was very rich with fur-bearing animals, so it was mainly for fur trade that they wanted to establish this sea route.
And the expedition scenes are full of, masculine egos, hierarchy, competition,
Oh, yes.
bureaucratic failure. What interested you, especially because later on in the novel, there's, I think, a real contrast with a different kind of approach to science. What interested you about this moment where science and empire become entangled?
Well, I think it's such an integral part of history of science. And we often talk about these expeditions as they would be purely motivated by the desire to advance science. But really deep down, they were very often quite imperial projects. And also in here, you can see that they had Stellar, the scientist, on board. But really, the science wasn't the reason they did this expedition. Science was sort of a, and you can see it also when we, in the next part, go to Alaska in the 1860s. And there, the fact that the governor needed to have a scientific collection, just so that they could say that this is a civilized mission. We're doing this to advance science, but ultimately it was about reaching new territories, this imperial project of finding new resources for the empire. And science was very much part of this project.
And Stellar was not treated very well by Bering.
Well, yes, he's a fascinating character, really, because he was a part of the crew of this ship where the hierarchies are super strict, the chain of command is very clear. But he really, you could say that he was a kind of person that had trouble with authority. He didn't shy away from speaking his mind. And that got ruffled some feathers with the authorities, with his superiors, and he wasn't very well liked. And let's say he wasn't very strategic about the way he went about telling his opinions. So in the end, he turned out to be quite disliked, yeah, by his superiors.
Yeah, and as you said, he is the only person who has been able to give an account of the Stellar Sea Cow, and that's because the sea cow went extinct within decades of being discovered.
Yes.
How did that happen, and what does that speed of extinction tell us about first contact, both historically and today?
Well, what happened that, well, they got shipwrecked on this desolate island and they were running out of food. And suddenly they discovered these huge beasts these gentle big creatures, and they realize that if they could learn to hunt these animals, that would resolve their troubles. They wouldn't go hungry anymore. And that what happened, they learned to hunt the sea cows, and it turned out to be, sadly, a very tasty animal. So at the moment when Stellar and the other members of the crew encountered this animal, when I first started reading the 18th century accounts of this encounter, something struck me as very odd about the way they described this animal and their relationship to it. And it took me a little while to realize why that was. And at some point, I just realized that yes, they have no idea that species can go extinct. The idea of extinction didn't exist in 1741. They had no clue that their actions could drive this species to extinction. So what Stella thought was that, okay, now they found the animal that will solve the problem of hunger in Siberia. This animal will feed the whole of Siberia and all our troubles will be solved. And he wrote when they finally managed to get back to the mainland, Stella wrote to St. Petersburg and told us, okay, on this island we have these wonderful tasty animals that you can hunt. And what happened was that the fur traders started to stop by this island, fill their barrels with the meat of the sea cow, and sail to Alaska. And it took only 27 years until this animal was hunted to extinction. But what was interesting was that they didn't realize that it had gone extinct, because they had no concept of extinction, no idea that they could really cause such a catastrophe. But what they thought was that this animal had just escaped to some more remote island away from the hunters. And for the next 100 years, they kept searching for the sea cows.
It's a tragic story, and I want to go back for a moment to the opening scene of this novel, Ida Turpainen, Beasts of the Sea, where you begin in a museum with the remains of the Stellar Sea Cow. Why did you choose to start the novel with the preservation and memorialization of the dead rather than life?
Well, because I think when I wrote this story and wrote this book, the one thing I realized that this book is really about, among other things, but one of the key things for me was the act of remembering. Because in writing this story, I wanted to find a way to show that the sea cow wasn't an isolated incident, but it was one link in this long chain of human-caused extinctions. And I had this very naive idea that maybe I could write a little eulogy, little sort of note to all of the animals that went extinct during the 7 years that it took me to write this book. And I thought, like, surely there were some species that went extinct. And then I went to see the Red List that. And I found out that there were almost 400 species that had gone extinct in the last 7 years. And really, my heart sank, because I thought I had followed the discussion on extinction quite closely during those 7 years. But I had maybe heard of four or five of those animals. And it means that almost 400 unique creatures disappeared from this world without us really even noticing. And this really, like, made me so sad, because how can we react to this catastrophe if we don't even notice it happening? And for me, this book was a way to speak against that amnesia, that collective amnesia that is taking place, and to tell the story of one of these animals, one of the animals that had gone extinct and that are worth being remembered and whose stories really matter and we should know. So for me, writing this book was part of that act of remembering.
Yes, it is tragic. I mean, it's an elegy, really, this book.
Yes.
And so let's move to the figure of Hilda Olson, because I think she represents a very different kind of approach to
Oh,
her
yes.
subjects and to memorializing them. I mean, she became an illustrator. Tell us her story.
When I realized that I was going to write a novel about history of science, the first thing I thought was that I don't want to write another story of the great deed of great men, a story where women are really non-existent. And of course, many stories of the history of science are like that, because women had no official role in science during those times. But at the same time, I was sure that surely there were some women that had some connection to this animal or to this skeleton that we have here in Helsinki. And I made it a conscious point of finding them out, finding them from the archives. And what interesting characters I ended up finding, like Hilda Olsson. I had no idea that she even existed. And she was like, she wasn't at all a known figure. And I found her completely by accident, because I knew that the professor of zoology, Alexander von Oudmann, in 1860s, when one of the sea cow skeletons came here in Helsinki, had given a lecture on this animal. And I knew the lecture had pictures, drawings of the animal in it. And I wanted to find it, but it was nowhere to be found. I ran through all the archives, all the libraries, and in the end I found one copy from one of these antique shops in Helsinki. I ran there, bought it, and started looking at the pictures, the drawings. And there was a signature, H. Olsson. I was like, okay, the professor had an assistant. I want to find a bit more about him. Who was he? And when it turned out that it was Hilda Olsson, a woman as an assistant of the professor of zoology in 1860s, like 40 years before women were admitted to the university in Helsinki, I really got curious. And Hilda Olsson, she was such a character. She was the daughter of a sea captain, but he was really a talented drawer, and she got accepted to the Fine Arts Academy in Helsinki. And what happened was that the professor, Alexander von Oudmann, he wanted to describe all the spiders that we have in Finland. And he wanted to do these wonderful drawings of these animals because he had a wonderful new microscope, which was a very new thing back in the days in Helsinki. But the problem was that his eyesight had started to fail. He couldn't see as well as he used to, so he needed an assistant. But as he himself was a very talented artist, he wouldn't accept any. He wanted a really talented artist to work with him. And at first he started to go through the candidates from the university's drawing school. But all the young men, he wouldn't qualify any of them because he didn't think they were good enough. And it seemed like finding a good assistant was almost impossible before someone tipped off that there is a very fine drawer in the Academy of Fine Arts, but she happens to be a woman. Like, would this be an issue? And Alexander von Oudmann invited Hilda Olsson over to tea, asked her to draw him a spider, and was so impressed by the quality of her work that she ended up hiring her. And they worked together for 6 years, traveling the world, drawing spiders, drawing insects, and drawing the sea cow. And in the end, Hilda Olsson ended up having a position as the assistant of the professor of zoology, like 40 years before women could enter the university. It was absolutely fascinating. The sad thing is that when the professor died, no one would hire Hilda in Finland because she was a woman. But she was a very resourceful woman. So what she ended up doing, she moved to London, worked as an artist and drew wallpapers for a living so she could find her way to earn her living as a drawer, which was quite exceptional for the time. So she was such an interesting figure. And what was sad was that she was completely forgotten, because all of her wonderful drawings were archived under the name of Alexander von Oudmann, her employee. But one of the most wonderful things that followed from publishing this book was that now last spring, her work was rediscovered. I got a call from the director of the Natural History Museum in Helsinki. They said that they read the book. They wanted to go find her work in the archives. And after they saw them, they were like, these are world class. We need to exhibit these. And she had an exhibition at the Natural History Museum. And then the director of the National Gallery phoned me and said that they did the same. They went to see her drawings and these are world class. And then she had an exhibition at the National Gallery. So she's been now rediscovered as an artist. And this makes me so immensely happy.
Oh, what a great story. That is really wonderful. And so, Ida Turpeinen, tell us more about Hilda's different way of seeing, really. You know, she doesn't conquer landscapes or name species. She really looks. And so talk about the difference between seeing and possessing.
Well, she worked as an assistant for a professor of zoology. And what is interesting, what we don't realize, that back in the day, the scientists always worked with an artist because you needed someone to record your findings. So you needed to find an artist to work with. And I find it very charming that in the letters of the scientists of the 17th and 18th centuries, and also in the 19th century, it is a very common topic to talk about how difficult it is to find the perfect artist to work with, because when you do this kind of a drawing, it isn't enough that you are a good drawer. You also need to understand the species you're describing very well, so well that you can, by looking at it, tell what are the characteristics that are common to the species and what are characteristics that are specific to this individual. So they need to know the species inside out to be able to produce this sort of one model picture of the species. And this is what Hilda also did. She studied spiders so meticulously that she could provide these kind of images that the scientists needed. And they are beautiful. You can see, I wish I could show you the pictures because, for example, the colors, the structures, they are exquisite. You can see that she is a very good artist. And while she is very careful to maintain scientific accuracy, but you can see how she plays with the colors, plays with the textures of the spiders' hairs and the different colors that they're... and the shapes that their bodies have. So it is a wonderful combination of the scientific and the artistic way of looking at these animals that I found utterly fascinating. And she also, as said, had to sort of to get a training as a scientist. She had to know how to collect the spiders, how to preserve their bodies in the way that you could draw anatomically correct images of them. But what I think is quite beautiful that she always wanted to draw her spiders from live models, which isn't that usual. So for her, the living animal represented something different. I don't know, it's hard to explain, but you can imagine typically what you do is that you take a spider, you drown it in ethanol or anything, and then you pin it down to a position that reminds you of the living spider, and then you draw it. But she, which is much more difficult, always made her drawings from live spiders because then the colors are more vibrant and you get to see the structure more clearly. And I think it is very fascinating. And sort of you can see it, maybe you could think that it is a sort of a little statement against that will to sort of possess and collect, even though she also took part in this part of science as well, because she also worked as a scientific assistant and they collected quite a good collection of the spiders that we now have here in the museum, in the archives.
In Helsinki?
Yes. And the wonderful thing is that now, as I collaborate, when writing this novel, I collaborated with the experts of the museum quite closely. And now that I'm writing my second novel, the director of the museum just said that, well, Ida, you're going to pester us anyway, so why don't you get a desk here? So now I'm working as a kind of a writer in residence at the Natural History Museum. So it really is a dream come true. This is utterly fascinating. And I get to work with their archives, which is a very different kind of archive, because as a humanist, I'm used to work with paper, diaries, letters and stuff. And now I have an archive that is quite different, because it's an archive made of flesh and bone of living animals. And it's very fascinating to think how to read that kind of an archive as a writer and as a humanist.
Yes, and say more about that, and tell us more about what a humanist is as well.
Well, a humanist. Well, for me, it was really when I've always been fascinated and drawn towards the natural sciences, mainly because my mother, when I was a kid, my mother was working on this nature reserve on this small island. And there I could follow the work of scientists quite closely. And that's a world that always was very fascinating to me. But at the same time, the world of literature had such pull. And when I graduated from high school and I had to decide what I want to go and study, it was so hard for me to decide between studying literature and studying science. But I ended up choosing literature. And what it means that I became a humanist, that I study, well, my field is comparative literature, so that I study literature texts and read them in context, in their cultural and historical contexts. So that's basically what I do.
And so a humanist then inside a museum, this is a museum, of course, is a place of the memorialization of things that are past. Talk about what that means.
I think it is very interesting to be here as a bit of an outlier. And then again, not at all. We talk about, in Finnish, it's called the Museum of Natural Sciences, but in the English-speaking world, we talk about natural history museums. And I think that makes a very good point, because these museums, they are, of course, often active research institutes, as this is as well. There are 200 researchers working here, studying the animals and the archives. But at the same time, they are the sort of archives that record our strange and changing relationship with nature, that you can find a history of science, which, and these fields, these are right up my alley as a humanist. What kind of understandings of nature do these archives reveal? And it's very interesting that when you go to the older parts of the archive, you start to find a lot of specimens, for example, that have been collected by quite famous artists. There is this one of our sort of national artists, Akseli Gallen-Gallela, and it turned out that during his travels, he collected a lot of scientific specimens and donated them to the museum. And at first I was like, this is odd. And then I realized that no, not at all, because at that time, in the 19th century, all the artists were trained in the techniques of natural science, because when you started to, for example, draw nature, the first thing you had to do was to go and shoot a bird, then to skin it, and then do a taxidermied version that you could then draw, because that was the only way of, for example, drawing birds from close up. They didn't have cameras or anything, so that was their techniques was where they're very close to the techniques that the scientists were using. So they were sort of collaborating in a very different level that we do today. So in a way, I think me being here as an author and as a humanist is sort of a nice return to the times when we used to collaborate quite closely. And it is quite interesting to think that what these archives mean, what do these archives mean for a person coming from a humanist background? What kind of stories can we read from them? And of course, for a writer, this is such a treasure trove. There are so many interesting and weird stories in these cellars that I have found enough stories for a lifetime.
And so you're deriving your second novel from a story you have uncovered at the museum?
Yes, once again, it's going to be about history of science and our relationship to animals, but this time a very different kind of animal. So it's going to be so much fun to write this book, and now to get to collaborate with the experts again and to learn. And to, for me, it's always so fascinating that to learn from the animals from the point of view of science and scientists, and then to think as a humanist, what are the roles that these animals have played in our culture and history? And to combine those ways of knowing and ways of talking about these animals is something that really I find fascinating and rewarding. And in a way, I think that, okay, here I've done the full circle. First, I was sorry that I had to choose between natural science and literature, and now I can sort of do a bit of both.
Well, I look forward to that second book and really enjoyed talking with you about your first novel, Beasts of the Sea, Ida Turpainen. It's just been great to talk with you about this. And also, it's such an important topic. I mean, that we understand what we're doing before it's too late.
Yes, it is such an important topic. And weirdly, when people ask me whether it was a very sort of devastating project to write about extinction for 7 years, like weirdly, I ended up coming out of this process more hopeful. Because when you look at it from the historical perspective, you realize how far we've already come and how much more do we know already. So weirdly, writing about the extinction of this animal has made me a bit more hopeful. And I think that is, in a way, quite a beautiful thing.
Ida Turpainen. You can read an excerpt from Beasts of the Sea by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.